world, and welcome to the Flyover Startups Podcast. I'm your host, Patrick Poehler. Each week, we interview founders who are building their businesses outside of Silicon Valley in the so-called flyover states. This week, we talk to David Carter of Jersey Watch. Jersey Watch is based in Athens, Ohio, and they provide a platform for youth sports organizations to build great custom websites for their organizations. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Patrick. Thanks for having me.
Great. Thanks for being here. So, David, let's begin. Where did you grow up?
You know, I'm from southern Pennsylvania, small town in the country, about an hour north of D.C. called Waynesboro.
Okay.
Probably never heard of it, but...
No, I haven't. So, kind of a small town, you know, how big is the town?
Less than 10,000 people. Okay. I was the youngest of four boys.
Oh, wow.
Athlete growing up through school. I actually went to a prep school in Virginia for a few years, and then my college track took me to Vanderbilt University. I was a defensive end, and then to Ohio University, where I finished up in 2008 with their business school, and then I rolled right into their MBA, Masters of Sports Administration program. So that's my, I guess, 10-second background of my educational path.
So sports was a passion of yours, like really, really starting off early, and especially in football. Did you get started in like peewee football, and or just your brothers beating up on you in the backyard?
That's interesting. I was one of those kids who wasn't allowed to play until, you know, about high school, middle school, high school time frame. So I was a soccer player, but you know, when you have three brothers, you're competing at anything. And so in our household, it often was sports, but it was, you know, good times there.
Yeah. Was your dad a player as well? And did he bring you guys up that way?
You know, he wasn't. I mean, he played in high school back in his day. You know, I think we were all just kind of average or above average high school players. And then I really took a interest with football, you know, just had a passion for it and was fortunate enough to get some opportunities to play, you know, at a higher level there.
So you went to Vanderbilt and played. Did you have aspirations of going pro in your football career, or was it really a ticket to get a scholarship through, through school?
I think that, you know, the goal for me was always I wanted to play Division I, and so I had the opportunity to go to Vanderbilt. I think everybody who plays at that level has dreams of possibly going pro at some point. I think for me, you know, that probably wasn't in the cards. Just with, I mean, it's another level, man. Yeah. And so I had a great run at it, though, in terms of playing and getting experience. I wouldn't trade for anything. But toward the end of my, I guess, even playing career, I mean, I was ready to be done, and it was a really neat opportunity.
You said you went through college. You went to Ohio State? No, I'm sorry, Ohio University.
Correct, yes.
Yeah, I know it's a big sin to mess those two up.
No, you're okay.
So what did you get your degree in? You went through the MBA program. What was your focus?
Yeah, it's a dual program here in Ohio. It's their MBA, Masters of Sports Administration program. I think actually just last year, it was ranked number one in the world of its type. I was really fortunate to get a chance to be a part of that very prestigious program. You know, at the time, wasn't sure where I was going to take it. Spent the next 2 years while I was going through that program really looking into opportunities, whether it's college athletics, professional football. I worked at the New England Patriots, did a little internship there. Just, you know, early 20s, you're not sure where you're going to land.
Yeah.
And at that point, it was just my intent was to get exposed to as many things as I possibly could to see what direction I might get in.
So even as a non-player or you know, maybe aspirations of going pro, you know, aside, you still wanted to make an impact in sports and athletics, it sounds like.
I think so. I think it seemed like a good fit just with my background. With sports comes passionate people oftentimes. Mm-hmm. And, even as I completed my schooling and got some unique opportunities to start this company and what we're doing with Jersey Watch, I think sports really brings a unique arena for whether it's startups or businesses, just because of that passion that people have for it. But we'll probably see more of that later in this conversation.
Yeah. Is it, do you think it's the competition and the team focus? Is that really kind of what, because I think there is a pattern. You see a lot of military guys, you see a lot of sports, people in athletics. They seem uniquely, prepared for entrepreneurship or business.
Yeah, that's a good observation. There has to be something there, I would think. I think it's the competitiveness. I think it's, folks who have for years of their life gotten up and done hard things and they didn't want to, and practice and improve themselves and scout themselves and get better. And I just think there's probably a lot of intangibles that, now we're generalizing, but often athletes will bring that. Mm-hmm. And even as we've hired on at our company and brought on other part-time folks, I mean, I love having whether former athletes or competitive driven folks like that. I think you're onto something.
Your family, did it have a huge impact on your career? Were any of your family members entrepreneurs? What really could you point to that gave you the entrepreneurship bug?
I don't know if I can pinpoint it exactly. My father did run his own medical practice when I was growing up. As the youngest boy, we all ran a small little lawn cutting business. I think a lot of people did that in high school. But probably what I would attribute to my family, I'm a big family guy. It's very important to me. But we're just probably a family of doers and people who work. And when you see a problem, hey, go find the solution, go build it, do yourself. Don't wait for somebody else to do it. And so we might be wired a little bit more like that. I don't know, that would probably have as much of effect as anything. But in terms of direct, like they're an entrepreneur, probably in their own way, maybe, but not necessarily, specifically an entrepreneur.
I see. Did you get a lot of support when you told your family that you were starting your own business?
It was a mixed bag. Mm-hmm. I think, and now as a new dad of 2 weeks.
Congratulations, by the way, publicly.
I appreciate that. Maybe down the road I'll get this a little bit more, but often when you step out down this, less trodden on path, I think there's a good chunk of folks who are like, whoa, is this safe and secure and what are you doing? But I think I had an equal mix from my family standpoint. They're really excited. They knew that we had some unique resources here supporting me. They knew it wasn't just me trying to go off on my own and starting something. But probably a mixed bag there, Patrick, to be candid. I don't know if that is clear or not.
Yeah. Yeah. Really just hopeful, concerned, you could describe it.
I think so. I think that's probably a great choice of words.
You currently work in Athens, Ohio, and that's where you've built Jersey Watch. What do you like about the area as a business owner? And is that a place you would encourage startup founders to build a business?
I would encourage it. It's a great area for us and our needs. You have the university setting here. Geographically, it's within an easy drive, Columbus, Cleveland, Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. We're actually incubated in the Innovation Center, which is a unique situation for us to be around other, I think there might be 20 to 25 other businesses.
Oh, wow.
In that complex. But the, probably the biggest draw for us is the ability to access student talent through the university. Tech Growth Ohio is located in Athens, who has been one of our supporters, have invested in us. So there's been a lot of resources that have, And without our location here, we never would have gotten this off the ground.
Hmm. So it sounds like, I mean, Athens is really behind entrepreneurs and is, you know, trying to make it an entrepreneurial hub.
I think there is a movement there. I don't have a ton of other locations, just to be honest, to compare it to. Mm-hmm. Some of the Columbus circles I've been up in, certainly that's where you and I first met. But there is. I think that they have strong resources, again, with almost the crossroads of university, Tech Growth Ohio, groups like the Innovation Center. And so I've tried to plug into them whenever I can.
Yeah, yeah. Do entrepreneurs in say the Incubation Center and part of Tech Growth, do you guys have regular meetups or, you know, sort of share information and strategies or talk shop with each other?
They do. They do a lot of organized, they call them lunch and learns and socials. They'll get different companies together. I think one of the neat parts about it is the companies are completely different. And the example I'll give you is, we're right down the hall from, I'm going to butcher this and what they do, but a startup company that's working with algae and how they can harness energy from a more green process that they are looking at. I know they have an aviation company downstairs from us. And in the mix of all these, what I call really, really smart people is this startup geared around youth and high school sports. So I think that eclectic mix is a unique part to it.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like it. So what was the genesis of behind Jersey Watch? I mean, how did you come up with the idea?
It's a good question. I was in my second year of graduate school, and we had to do some practicum, special problems. And I was really digging into the high school and youth levels of the sports industry are really the Wild West. You have the collegiate space, professional sports, everybody knows about. But the next area for growth really is the youth and high school levels across the country. And as I dug into that and did some projects, you thought, boy, there are needs here. They don't have many resources, very limited budgets, and often staffed by volunteers. And yet, if you look at it from a brand perspective or advertising or marketing, this is the audience that companies really want to get in front of. Hmm. They want to be local. They want to be grassroots with families and communities. And is there a way that we can connect those two parties that really hasn't been done before? And so that's where the early seeds started for the idea and concept. Mm-hmm. And the further I went along, I finished up my schooling and, again, back to some of those resources with Tech Growth and others, I thought, I think we have a chance to do something here. We could connect these parties, serve the youth, serve these high school organizations, and then drive down some advertising and regional sponsorships that would really fund our model in a way that no one's doing. And that's what we're doing.
So once you had the idea, and it was an idea that just, it sounds like you just couldn't let it go, really. you immediately went out and started seeking investors. How did you just go about finding the investor capital and, raising it? Did you just use the university's connections?
Probably a blend of a lot of areas. For our idea, though, we had to have some type of proof of concept. And without myself being able to, say, build our product to go demonstrate it, I was really in a tough situation. Mm-hmm. And so fortunately, Tech Growth Ohio has some programs through Ohio's Third Frontier that you can be awarded some funding to go build your prototype and show a proof of concept. So I was able to go through, and there's a lot of steps to the process in pitching to them. And once they invested in us and we could get the product out to market and show the business model working in Columbus, and you were very involved in this, mm-hmm. That's really in terms of the investment and your question on investors. that's when that really came to life.
I see.
Now they can see really what you're doing.
I see. How many pitches to Tech Growth Ohio did it take to get the initial seed to build the prototype?
Oh my! I'm not sure, but they do have a very formal process. And I think through that, now this is the fall of 2011. Mm-hmm. I probably went in front of one of their even just entrance committees three or four times before they even let this thing get in front of like their investment committee. And so there probably would have been, five or six pitches along the way. And it was really helpful, but looking back on it, and I still have the decks, the early presentation decks from the first pitches. I mean, they were terrible. you kept polishing, you kept improving. And I think that's something that I've been really good at, is just to take feedback. I'm a pretty good listener, and how can we get better? And so, no, it was quite the process, but we got lucky, and they've been a big part of this.
I see. And when you were polishing your decks, did you engage youth sports organizations and get their feedback and use that real-time feedback to improve your pitch and your information?
I did. That was really hard, but I had to go out and, I can't stand in front of a room and say, these groups want this if I haven't spoken to them.
Yeah.
So I spent in that November, December window, 3 or 4 weeks, and I'm just bombarding these organizations. I mean, think about this. I'm calling these programs with no product, and I'm basically asking them, if we build this, would this help you, and would you be interested?
Wow.
And we were able to get enough kind of verbal commitments. Yeah, we'll test that out. Yes, that would help us. And we collected that data so we could go back to, Tech Growth Ohio and others to say, look, this isn't just a hunch. There's a need here. And I guess I built up enough of that, those comments and mass to make it stick and resonate with them.
So really it was just like nose to the grindstone, just picking up the phone, cold calling as many people as you could think of, and just, trying to sell them the idea and get them excited about it, without even having anything, really tangible.
Really selling something you don't have. That's kind of a funny sentence, right? but that's what it was. And I mean, looking back on it, you wouldn't trade it for anything, but there was a lot of grinding, as you say. There was no doubt about it. You're calling in, cold call, cold call, cold call, cold call. And then, because deep down, you know, these groups probably needed this, and you just need to connect to the right people. So,
yeah. David, when I describe you to other people, I say you're the ultimate hustler in the startup terminology, the ultimate, just persistent, in a very nice and very, very friendly way, but you are, determined.
I appreciate that. Those are kind words. I'm certainly stubborn at times, but I think, the persistence is key for what we're doing. Absolutely.
After you got the initial seed round from Tech Growth Ohio to build the prototype, I mean, how did you bring together the resources like Aneka and Greenline Creative? How did you really find us? And I mean, how many other companies did you go through to, to find? And can you tell me like what happened after you got that funding?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we get awarded the funding, and then we're in almost a tricky spot. Because we can't miss on this. We need to find the right group to build this, let's just call it version one. So I undertook a variety of meetings and interviews with groups here locally in Ohio, most in central Ohio. I did some in Cincinnati, a few firms out of Chicago, even down in Atlanta. And, I was calling groups, trying to explain what we're doing, getting quotes, getting pricing. But one of the main pieces for me was even just personality fit. It's interesting, a non-technical person trying to evaluate a technical firm for lack of a better term. Fortunately, the Green Line and Aneka connection, just from the beginning, was a unique relationship. And there was something different about when I first met Dennis and Julie and yourself, that you, I think you guys really embraced the uncertainty and the unknown of the product. Mm-hmm. And so that's ultimately how the decision was made. I don't know if you can recall back a few years now. How, I don't know what your initial reaction was, but.
Yeah. My initial reaction was like, oh my gosh, if we can pull this off, it'll be really, really something.
Yeah. No, and you did. I think, but in terms of like that process and evaluating, that was key. We couldn't afford to miss with that group. And fortunately, you know, we nailed it.
Great. So during the, you know, you mentioned it's difficult, you know, it was interesting as a non-technical founder, you were trying to vet technical sure. talent. Is that something you continuously, sort of maybe struggle with in a lot of ways of like you know, Jersey Watch is a website and it's got a lot of technical like requirements, and you know, being a non-technical founder, you sort of have to put your faith in other people in order to make sure that the business's goals sometimes get accomplished when it comes to the site. Is that a difficult position to be in?
I think it's stretching at times. Mm-hmm. As you might expect, there are challenging aspects to that. I mean, certainly, it's an area that you have to put a lot of trust into your team. When Patrick, when we continued after that initial version one, and now what we've been working together for maybe 18 months, we've built a lot of trust equity there. But early on, you know, that was a little bit of a friction just on expectations on our end. And just to put a candid example would be, how long things take and what type of work requirements. And so I think on my end, probably the best piece of advice I was given early on by one of my advisors when I was experiencing some frustration with this, just because I couldn't really control it, if you think about it.
Yeah.
Because it's not an area I own. But I remember them, and I still to this day, one of my advisors said, you know, this isn't the death threat at all. You know, the death threat to your business model is figuring out these other elements. So stop being concerned or focusing on these other areas. And that was great advice for me at that time. And I've gotten better at this. And I think I continue to do, and hopefully you've even witnessed, you know, in terms of communication and expectations that we've grown. But, yeah, I think you're right though. That is a challenge, but, we've worked through it.
Yeah. So your advisor, I mean, was basically instructing you that, hey, the technical stuff is important, but it's not nearly as important as, you know, sign on YSOs and sign on sponsors and maybe some of the other things in the business.
Correct. I think he did a great job of focusing me in on what was the important elements. And at that time it was, we have to go sell this thing. It is good enough to sell. Let's go sell it and stop whether getting bogged down in elements that weren't really where we needed to be. So that was just, you know, as a young guy, first time doing this, I needed to hear that. And that was a key moment for us.
Yeah. Was your advisor an investor in Jersey Watch, or was he a mentor that you had a connection with?
You know, this particular one was not an investor. Just through one of Tech Growth's, they usually assign a point of contact or mentor person to you. And so his name was Sean Mallett. I'm still in contact with him today. So,
do you think that having a mentor is an important thing for an entrepreneur to have, whether you're running a startup or, you know, any other kind of business?
I know I needed them and still need them for sure. I think it's, you know, very early on, one of the first things we did, even before I was fortunate enough to get this funding was we put together an advisory board. And so we have, I think it's right around 6 to 8 individuals. You know, these are savvy business minds in the sports industry. They know what they've 20 years experience, 15, whatever it may be. You know, at the time I'm 25. I don't know what to do, for lack of better words. I think I have an idea on the path. And, I think just getting back to that whole listening piece, I would go to them and still do with a strategic problems, challenges, where are we headed? What is typical in the industry? And that stuff is invaluable for me. So I would say absolutely.
Did you know any of your, sort of advisory board before you started Jersey Watch, or like, how did you get introduced, and how did you bring your board together?
Yeah, it came together in some different steps. So I knew several of them, had to go recruit some others. And in some cases, an advisor like introduced you to another friend or colleague of theirs, which might have led to an investor and another. And so I think the key was just to find out who might be interested in this. Certainly this is not for everybody. And that's part of the beauty with it. And so I was able to, I guess, at least corral or intrigue enough people, enough of the right people who kind of believed in what we were trying to do and still believe in what we're doing. But I don't know. There wasn't really any shortcut with that. It was conversations. It was calls. It was grabbing coffee. It was plugging into our Ohio network here. And, you know, even just back to selling, you had to go sell yourself, sell the vision. And, you know, that soon led to bumping into the right people.
Back to that persistence. I love how you just said there's no shortcuts, and it's oh so easy to think there are shortcuts.
Sure. No, we all look for them, don't we?
Yeah. Absolutely. So after the product was, you know, sort of built and you had your launch date set, how did you go about on a marketing side launching Jersey Watch and just getting those initial youth sports organizations on board?
Yeah, from day one, even back to when we were first just getting comments or feedback from these youth organizations, it's just been a direct sales effort. And I mean, you probably cringe, and your audience probably cringes when they think of that as hauling and cold calling, but it works for what we do. It works really well. And if you compare our sales ratios of, you know, if we make 100 calls and how many demos we can schedule and how many groups we close in the sales world, those are really good ratios. So that's been the backbone for us. We see some organic, like we have like a little halo effect because a lot of our customers are geographically bound. So in Central Ohio, where you're at, if we get the Pickerington program, we're probably going to bump into Canal Winchester and Liberty Union and naturally groups that they play. So we tried to be strategic with how we called, but we really got out and hit the phones on this. I mean, that pushed it in Central Ohio. That's what launched Cincinnati, launched Dayton, launched Cleveland. And I'm looking forward to actually this quarter, we're rolling out our first kind of indirect marketing effort. Believe it or not, we're just now trying to supplement our direct sales with some SEO and email marketing.
Oh, wow.
Some other not as contact heavy efforts, just because it's been driving the ship for us.
Yeah, and that's after like over a year and a half, right? So how many calls a day, I mean, does it take? I mean, how many calls a day did it take, and how many conversations on average do you think you and your team put in?
You know, it ebbs and flows. I think, you know, we use Salesforce.com and we live in that. I always like to say, if it's not in Salesforce, it didn't happen. And we are very particular in that. You know, right now on a given week, not too bad, you know, 20 to 30.
Okay.
You know, for people who are really in sales, that volume is not unbearable. Probably when we were, maybe a year ago, that might have been higher. But you still got to have a life. It's not completely at sure. some point of diminishing returns. But I think it's the habits, you know, the weekly habit. How many are we getting out a week? How many demos we schedule in a week? And so I'm very data driven from that perspective.
Yeah. And what's your close rate? On those calls. I mean, what's kind of your conversion ratio, as they say?
Yeah, I know it. That's a great question. Everybody, it's tough to compare those apples to apples because our steps in the sales funnel are a little bit different. Mm-hmm. Right now, though, I'll walk you through our main steps. If we call 100, let's keep this easy. We're going to get through to at least 50% on the first cold touch, which is really good. Hmm. And we're looking to get demos with probably around 25 to 30 of those. And if we can close in that teens range, 10 to 15 right now, I mean, that's really remarkable. And, we're pretty close there. So those are probably some typical steps for us in terms of, our sales process.
Yeah. It sounds like a strategy that's really worked well. I mean, you've opened in every major city in Ohio, using that process, and you're just now getting to some of the online marketing. So it's an amazing accomplishment.
Well, I appreciate that. We'll see. We'll see how it goes. I think it speaks to the need more than what we're doing. But we'll see where it comes.
Well, I think it's and what's fascinating, and this is why I wanted to have this talk with you, is that in some ways, by being a non-technical co-founder and coming from more of like a sales background, or maybe having more of a salesperson type attitude, you are able to do things that a lot of startup founders sometimes are unwilling to do because it quote unquote doesn't scale. And you know, you've made it, you know, you've made it successful part of your business. Paul Graham says, just do things that don't scale, and you're clearly, you know, doing those things.
Well, you know, it's interesting that term, because this has come up a lot. You know, we have a board and investors and these investment committees and they're always, well, how's this going to scale? And how do you really distribute this nationally? And that's where we want to go. And it's funny, the other week someone asked me, you know, it just seems like how direct sales oriented this product is right now, that this is going to take a lot of work to really scale and push it. And I had to chuckle to myself. I said, well, what else would it take? I mean, of course it's going to take a lot of work. And I think for us and what it is in the market we serve, there's always going to be that direct piece and component that might not necessarily, that might turn some people off, and just in terms of how it can go and virally go, that makes sense.
Is there anybody outside of Jersey Watch that is kind of supporting, sort of advocating this region by region growth process?
Well, I think you could turn to a lot of different industries. And if you peel back some companies that might not follow the clicky startup hockey stick growth curve, but if you think about it, how do they grow? Well, they learn what they're doing initially where they're at. And if they're going to grow out in different territories, they often will have territory sales executives or reps, or, have state or regional contact or representation. I mean, a lot of those fundamentals don't seem that unfamiliar to a lot of industries. So I don't think in terms of that approach for us that there's a lot of weakness there, but again, it's pretty early in the game here. So maybe in the next year or two, we can have this conversation again to say, hey, how'd the rollout to the Carolinas work, and how did that go down in Texas? And hopefully we'll figure it out.
What's your biggest day-to-day challenge in running a startup? What's the one thing that just constantly, and I know there's a million things, but what's your biggest challenge? What are you most singularly kind of focused on in terms of like, we have to do this right if we're going to be successful?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I would say, I hope this doesn't get too theoretical for you. is the blend of executing and the tactical and the calls every day and the building websites and communicating with clients and the tactical work and blending that with strategy. And I had once, not to just beat on my mentors, but I had a mentor one time tell me, you know, it's almost like, I'll use a battlefield analogy. Like, you have, as the entrepreneur, you have to be able to fly above and see where everything's going, the strategic level, and then swoop down and get on the ground and fight. And I think that blend is really hard, because if you do too much tactical, you're not going to raise your capital. You're not going to, you know, position for some, maybe a big spring campaign, or, but if you live too much in the strategy, you won't go do anything.
Right.
And so that rub, and maybe there's a fancier way to explain it, is, I think, the biggest challenge. And I would say for us, you know, it's every day you probably make 50 decisions that in themselves aren't super important, but the cumulative effect of them is very important. And so I think those all lend itself to a very challenging situation. And for us, probably we're constrained by seasonality more than other businesses. Sports seasons and advertising and media buyers buying at certain points of the year. So we have to acquire and grow based on some of these calendar restraints. So that's also a pretty big challenge in our book. So I kind of went a couple different ways with that one, Patrick, but hopefully the audience can relate to that.
Yeah. So do you find the off season to be your biggest time in terms of your focus during that time of growing and signing up new organizations and getting sponsors and raising money? Or is it during the actual season where you're finding you're most busy?
You know, it's probably too early to tell. One of the wrinkles of the whole thing is there seems to be no off season for half the audience or half the groups that we serve. So if they're playing baseball, they're playing fall ball, they're spring soccer, fall soccer. And you add in the holidays and 4th of July weekends, and next thing you know, there's really not a ton of great windows to go acquire or go meet. So as a result, we're trying to be strategic there when we do certain activities. But I think we're still figuring that one out. Hopefully in the next 90 days, we'll have really nailed that down. We'll have gone through a full calendar year then with our version 2, which we really like. And we'll probably have a better perspective of that looking back on it.
Yeah. How big has your team grown over the past year? I know you've hired on some folks like Tim, and you brought on Alex. Have you had any trouble finding new members onto the team?
Yeah, we've been very fortunate to, I think, attract some of the right people. Tim, we brought on last spring, full-time. He came out of Ohio's sports ad program as well. With our relationship here, we have graduate students who work with us part-time, some 20, 30 hours a week. Certainly our technology team, with the NECAs in Columbus. We have a designer in Cincinnati. The remote thing's working for us. We really like it. And then probably one of the stronger aspects to our team is, you know, we have anywhere from 6 to 8 student undergrad workers from the university who come in and around class time and do a lot of the tedious work, the data mining, the prospecting, the finding these organizations. That's critical to what we do. So right now our team's still very small, relatively speaking, but I think we're getting a lot out of them.
So, you found a way to sort of, you know, scale some of the onboarding issues and, you know, the day-to-day maintenance of the site just by, again, tapping into the university connection and taking advantage of the internship, you know, programs at Ohio University.
Correct. It's been a big tool for us, in particular on those things you mentioned, the onboarding, getting our clients up to speed, building these sites. I think that's been a big advantage for us.
Yeah. How has the idea grown over a year and a half of the site being online? And, You mentioned version two. I mean, what were some of the things that you thought were going to be really critical that turned out to be maybe not so critical? And conversely, what were the things that seemed trivial but then turned out to be a really big deal for your customers?
Yeah, great question. And I might just turn the microphone back to you. And it's sometimes you chuckle when you look back on what we initially wanted to build. And we didn't know. We tried to build everything to everybody, which at the time was the best we could do. But as the further we got in, the more conversations we had, the more selling we did, that product, and Patrick, you could speak to this, became more narrow and focused and focused and focused. And we spent some time early on building some features that were not necessary. That's okay. I think you get better. You don't want to try to repeat that. But that's probably, even back to your initial question of a non-technical founder, not having that type of perspective, that's probably some growing pains that I encountered early on.
Yeah.
Just very excitable. Yeah, we need this and this and this. And well, no, we don't. We don't need that. At the end of the day, they need these things. And so probably without going into too much detail on what those features are, that certainly happened to us without a doubt. Yeah.
It's fascinating because I think this is a common thing like everybody makes, even probably especially even technical founders who, you know, we like to engineer and add features and never talk to a customer. But what I think you know, to your benefit is you were not afraid to really get down tactical and actually talk to your users and find out what they were using and what they really wanted. And that really informed your decision of, you know, the direction to take Jersey Watch as a product.
I think that was key for us. I don't know if you recall last June, so June 2012, we really nailed just like a simple 2x2 matrix to how we split up our market.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
It was key for us to say, hey, we're only going to focus on certain quadrants that make sense, and cutting off that fourth quadrant that was sucking all of our time and was a space of the industry we never would win at. That was a big step for us. So, part of learning.
Yeah. So what's next for Jersey Watch? Are there any new announcements or new features, new markets you might be rolling out to?
Yeah, we have a lot of exciting things going on. This fall, we will be opening up Indianapolis and Detroit. So this will begin our national expansion outside of
that's Texas. Exciting.
Yeah, it's big for us. We've been data mining in those markets all fall. We're ready to go. And so once the fall sports season ends, we will be blitzing that pretty hard. On our product side, we have a neat payment processing gateway that will launch as a great feature set. A lot of our users have asked for this so they can take online payments. This is something that you and your team have been working on, and we're really excited for. It's going to be a game changer for us. We have groups ready to use it on day one. and we got more on the turn of the calendar who have been anticipating this release. So I think those are the two big things as we head into 2014, and then, you know, who knows where we'll go from there.
Well, it's very exciting. A lot of great things, on the way for Jersey Watch. And, David, I think that about wraps it up. This has been a great interview, and I really appreciate, you know, you taking the time to speak to me and to the audience.
You got it, Patrick. It was a pleasure. I hope folks got something out of this, and, you know, I hope we can do it soon again.
Well, that does it for this episode of the Flyover Stars podcast. Thanks to David Carter of Jersey Watch for the interview. You can check out the site by going to jerseywatch.com. You can follow Flyover Startups at FlyoverFM on Twitter, or go to our site, flyover.fm. You can also find us on iTunes. Feel free to rate and review the show. If you or someone you know has a startup in a flyover state, send us an email at contact@flyover.fm. I'm your host, Patrick Poehler. Thanks for listening.